Hello, welcome to Greenlit with me, the voice which belongs to Toby Earle. In each episode of Greenlit, a guest receives the thrilling news their life is to be made into a biopic, and we discuss how that story will be told. Will they star? Which moments won't make it into the adaptation? And will Dracula make an appearance? In this episode, writer, former stand-up and Viz contributor extraordinaire Christina Martin will plot the course of this certain blockbuster. Martin was the bronze medalist in 2006's Funny Women Awards. She's a Viz writer and continues to be its most prolific letter writer. She's one of the funniest people Richard Herring knows. Her debut book, Writing as Evie King, is due to be released in March 2023. And her experimental silent jazz album reached the coveted 74th spot in the Icelandic charts. Christina Martin, welcome to Greenlit.
Hello. Are you all right?
Yeah,
What was the last thing?
Do you remember your experimental silent jazz album, which went to number 74 in the Icelandic charts?
God, I've completely forgotten that. Mind you, that's jazz for you, isn't it, man?
1 minute it's there, the next it's gone. So there's a lot going on there, and I'm just so glad to have one of the funniest people Richard Herring knows on.
He doesn't know many people. Hello, it's nice to see you as well. It's like meeting a French pen pal, because I've only known you on Twitter.
Well, bonjour, je m'appelle Toby. Welcome to Greenlit, Christina Martin. But first things first, is it pronounced biopic or biopic?
I think biopic, you know, but I don't know. I don't know if I'm just uncultured, but biopic sounds like something like kind of like what your nan. Well, actually, I should change my reference from nan to mum now, because both nans are dead. So it's my mum who'd be more likely to be mispronouncing things of the zeitgeist now. You know, it sounds like when your parents try and grasp for a word that they've seen written down,
or they over, like you say, overpronounce a word because they're uncertain of its pronunciation.
Yeah, give all of the word a go. So every syllable gets a big good go, and then I probably will hit it at some point.
Biopic it is, straight to the point, punchy. Would that kind of attitude continue to the meeting that you're going to have with these studio executives about making this film of your life? Where would you have that meeting, Christina, with these studio executives? Would you want it at the studio? Would you want it in one of their offices? Or would you have it in a swanky restaurant? Or would you have it somewhere else?
I think I would wrong foot them and meet them at the Morrison's Cafe, something like that, you know? Just get them on my territory. Get them away from their territory and on my territory, so I'm in control. You know, we're in a really low rent place. I've got all the power. They don't know what their environment is. They don't know how to order. They're completely on the back foot, and then they'll give me all the money because they'll be so confused.
Now, what is it about the Morrison's Cafe you like as a venue?
They've got a bus, a little child's bus in it. The destination is Hungry Town, which actually seems like the wrong destination for a cafe, because it should take you away from Hungry Town. That's another thing that would confuse them. And, you know, it's a nice feature. There's a little bus here. There's dirty tables. There's very below average food, for everything. With the cost of living crisis, I've got to meet them somewhere I can, you know, afford.
they're paying.
I'm still playing mind games though, aren't I?
Exactly.
Yeah, even if they're paying, yeah. I'll just get more Twixes.
I've got to, Morrison's Cafe, what would you recommend?
Sandwich, any sandwich, whatever you prefer. You know, obviously I'm not going to dictate your sandwich fillings to you, but I'm egg and cress.
Egg and cress?
Some crisps. Some crisps, very basic bitch me. Some crisps, and maybe not a fizzy drink. I'm trying to be better, so maybe a box carton drink.
Juice. A box carton. What, like a Just Juice?
Yeah, like a child's lunchbox drink. And a Twix. Five Twixes. They're paying.
The thing is, you never hear people normally going for a Twix. Like they got literally they have anything, and you've gone for a Twix. Are you?
You don't see them advertised. No one talks about them. It's almost like they don't exist.
Did you try one of their winter spices?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. You can hear from my voice the concern in my voice how that went.
Not a fan.
Sound like someone. Yeah, I sound like a correspondent. Yeah, the Department of Health being asked about COVID. Well, as was, it doesn't exist anymore, does it? It finished the other Thursday. It tasted like it had been left to go off, like there was something wrong with it. I could tell what they tried to do. I could taste the attempt at mulled wine, but it just came out mouldy.
It was a bit like eating potpourri, wasn't it?
Yes, that's exactly right. That's the analogy. It shouldn't be in food form. It's a scent. It's a scent. It was like toilet duck.
Would you eat a toilet duck twirl?
Yeah. I always eat them. I know I'm going to hate them, but I buy all the special editions, the white chocolate ones that I know are going to be insipid. I had white chocolate Rice Krispies once. They were awful. I knew they would be when I bought them. Pink white chocolate Rice Krispies, again, just terrible. My marketer's dream. If you take a normal snack and just change it slightly, I'll be there.
What's your dream sort of modified snack then? Is there something you've thought about that you would love to see?
Cheese Snickers. Just improvised that. I don't mean it. I should have it in my heart. I should access that information instinctively as my dreams. But it's such a big question. I'd need a day.
I was also wondering about the view from the Morrison's Cafe as you're sat there with these high-powered Hollywood executives. What's the view of the Morrison's Cafe? Is it of the back of the tills opposite certain aisles, or is there a car park?
Well, it depends where you're sitting, doesn't it? Because if you're sitting in the sort of inside bit, you can see the tills, you can people watch. Or if you prefer a view, you can go towards the window area and watch people go up and down the travelator and watch the cars come in and out and petrol and things like that.
So
the world's your oyster. It's up to you. Really.
I forgot about the travelator. Do you ever sit in the cafe watching people on the travelator and doing a gladiators commentary?
Oh, you can't not sing Travelator in your head as gladiators, can you? The Travelator. I like to watch people. I particularly like to watch people mucking up the Travelator's sort of natural rhythms by not pushing their trolley quickly enough. And people are starting to panic behind them. They're not dismounting. And my trolley's going to go up your farm. I was on a Travelator in Morrison's once behind Bernard Cribbins.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
I know. He was good. He dismounted correctly and went off into the store. And I occasionally saw him around. He wasn't like, sometimes you get on the same track as someone, don't you? Opposite. And you pass them in every aisle. And sometimes they're your nemesis. But he only popped up occasionally again after that. He was quite a mysterious character. He disappeared into the store. And I think I only saw him again near the crisps. And then he was gone.
Cribbins just melting away like a thief in the night with a trolley.
That's my best story ever.
Well, exciting news. Your life has been greenlit for a biopic. But how would your life be told by Hollywood or Bollywood or Nollywood? And what sort of creative control would you exercise in bringing the greatest story you know to the big screen? So, first big question, Christina Martin. What's the film called?
Well, I've thought about this. And I've decided it should be called Christina with an A, because, believe it or not, Christina baffles millions of people as a name. Or maybe they're too lazy, I don't know. But I've worked with some people for 5 years now who still call me Christine. They know intellectually, on an intellectual level, they know I'm called Christina because they type my email address in to speak to me. But then they will, in the salutations, they will say Christine. And people will be introduced to me and seconds later will say, thanks, Christine. And I just want to impress in the title from the get-go. It's Christina with an A. Christina, please.
You say people do this regularly. Has it been your whole life?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. I mean, my name when I was young, I'm 42 now. So when I was in the early 80s, everyone was called Louise or Sarah or Emma. That was the three names that everyone had. And my name, there were some mums going to my mum, oh, get you, kind of like she called me Shakira or something, you know? Like really, really exotic name you decided upon there. Ooh, Ponce. And so there wasn't really much experience of my name back then. And then Christina Ricci turned up, or Richie turned up in the early 90s, didn't she, as Wednesday Addams. And so it got sort of into the zeitgeist, into the public consciousness.
Yeah.
So some people at that point were au fait with my name, but it was still a bit kind of, it's basically Christine, isn't it, what you're called, basically. Let's correct it. Everyone was auto-correcting my name, like they're changing fuck to duck. Just every phone changes Christina to Christine. And Yeah, and you get to the point where now it's a 50-50 shot whether anyone decides to call you by your true name or just autocorrects you. And I'm too polite to say, I don't want to be that person who goes, Christina. I know people who've got a name. I won't say who they are because it's a really distinctive name. But I know someone who's got a name and they've decided it's pronounced slightly differently than it is. It's clearly, it can be pronounced.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So they've decided there's an emphasis at the end and they spend their life going, no, and it's, I don't want to be going, you know, I don't want to be correcting people and I don't want to be that guy. So I just stay as Christine for some people, like the shadowy figure, like Batman, Bruce Wayne, Christine.
You can say some terrible things and they go, God, isn't Christine horrible? Christina?
On the other hand, she's so spiky. She's so prickly.
Oh, she's awful.
Corrects you. Yeah. So.
So it's Christina with an A. So people know straight away.
Yeah.
Well, what's the opening scene, Christine?
Oh, hello, you did that.
What's the opening scene to Christina with an A?
It's important to have impact in your opening scene, isn't it? So I was thinking of just straight out stealing the opening scene from Goodfellas. So I'm driving along at night. Two other blokes, I don't know who they are. And there's some noise coming from my boot. It wouldn't be that precise car. I drive a Micra, so I'd have it as a Micra. Just
no, please have it. Please have it. Please have it in a Micra.
Have it as a Micra. There's some noise coming from the back. And then we pull over, we shoot the guy dead. And then I slam the boot and say, ever since I was a little kid, I always wanted to be a gangster. Then we can cut to, but I didn't in the end. as it turns out, I did a fair amount of perfunctory sort of admin work, non-committal day jobs, a little bit of writing on the side. Nothing exciting. I don't really know why we're making a film about it. That could be the opener. There's sort of big boom and then me being understated. I think it sort of represents me quite well. So all the best stuff starts in the middle as well, doesn't it? That film starts in the middle. It starts at the end or the middle. That's when you know it's like really sophisticated and good cinema.
Or they don't know how to start the film.
Starting is difficult, isn't it? Deciding how you introduce something. So just start at the end and then it looks arty.
Yeah.
And you don't have to admit that you didn't know how to start.
I really love the understatement, which is obviously massive, but I really like the idea of wanting to be a gangster, but then, you know, our life is, you just end up doing a few admin roles, don't you?
I tried. I didn't have the connections. I didn't have a gun. I didn't live in America or the East End particularly much.
Do you think there is a lot of admin in being a gangster? Or is that why it appealed so much? The fact that there doesn't seem to be a lot of admin in being a gangster?
Well, that's it. You don't have to do tax returns, do you? Which is one of the things that put me off. Because I do PAYE as in my day job, which is one of the reasons that kept me there, because I didn't want to do tax returns. So I only ever did stand up and writing as a hobby because I didn't want to do admin of tax returns. My whole life has been dictated by how much I can be bothered to do in terms of, oh, that's a hassle. So I will give up my dreams to not have to do a tax return. Yeah, stand up and writing professionally. I just kept them on the side hustle and didn't push too hard and then gave up stand up altogether. Mind you, I would have done that by now anyway, I'm knackered. But yeah, it didn't appeal to me. All my friends were always doing tax returns and I was just thinking, God, no, I'll stick to the civil service, do that on the weekend.
There are some people might say, well, I think you'll find there might be some comedians who don't do their taxes properly.
Right. Well, see, some of them didn't give up their dream and tried to keep some of the cash. And I can understand that as well. Just didn't want to do the admin. I don't think that was even great. I think that was, oh, no, don't make me do HMRC paperwork.
When did you realise you preferred not having to do your taxes over following your dreams? When did that hit?
I think when I was 30. So because I remember I stopped stand-up bang on 30, then had spent a decade just working and trying to pay down my mortgage. And that was my lost wilderness years of admin and mortgage. It's a bit of the movie, I think, that will not interest many people.
Right.
Apart from mortgage advisors.
Is a mortgage advisor who's being slaughtered in the back in the boot of the Nissan?
Or the tax man. Well, actually, no. I'm not getting involved with him. Don't even want him in my boot.
You gave up doing stand-up bang on 30.
Yeah, I just chose one of my gigs as my last. I stopped booking them and kept that one as my, that's going to be my last gig. And just what, saw that as my swan song.
What was your last stand-up gig then? Where was it?
Oh, it was in Camden, and it was Josie Long's Treasures of the, what is it? Treasures of the Lost. It's got a funny name, and right. It's probably not in existence anymore because it's obviously over 10 years ago. Oh, Lost Treasures, that's it. Lost Treasures of the Black Heart. And it was about your unsung heroes. So it was quite a good one to finish on because I wasn't doing my normal set. We all had to turn up with a subject about an unsung hero of ours. And I turned up with like loads of print offs and stuff to demonstrate my point. And it was all about live late night TV presenters who effectively talk to themselves. You know, it's amazing skill when you think about it. They're at one in the morning, effectively just talking to themselves. And so I did the guys who do Quiz Call, or did Quiz Call. I don't think that exists anymore either. This is the problem. Most things don't exist anymore now. They used to do those phone-in quizzes where you would have to answer a rigged question. That was that famous one about what do women keep in their handbag, and it was roll plugs, wasn't it, one of the answers.
What?
Yeah, and you had to pay about £5 a minute to phone it, to say something that should be correct, like lipstick or what, and they'd go, nope. And they'd have like games as well, so there'd be a word and a blank, or, you know, so you had to fill in what it could be. And they had blank horse, and people were phoning in trying to guess what it could be. And someone phoned in and said high horse. And the guy had obviously not heard of that as a phrase. So he was just chuckling away after they'd gone, going, yeah, don't know what that is. I think they mean a shire horse. They're quite high. So it's amazing viewing. But the main one that I was celebrating was obviously Peter Simon from the Shopping Channels, obviously.
Yeah.
With his manner of speaking and unique approach to selling products. So get his hands dirty, getting into his shorts and getting on the Vibra Power, shaking his belly, showing you his belly shaking, sweating, shouting, viewer! Oh! You know? That was my last gig, just talking about those things. What a way to finish.
But why was it that you wanted to finish? Was it just the thought of doing your own taxes and that paperwork, or were there other reasons?
I mean, that was, you know, there, but ultimately I wasn't up for doing it for a living. You know, when you've done certain points of something, you know, like the main points of something. So you played this place, you've met this person, you've done this thing, you've placed in a comp, you know, been to Edinburgh. I didn't do an Edinburgh show, but I went in a showcase for a bit. So I'd sort of checked off a few things. It was almost like a bucket list thing to do a stand-up. I never had any arrogant ideas that I would be famous or lauded or anything. So I just did it for fun and to meet people. So I met my kind of people doing that. You know, you find your people where you sort of have your interests.
Yeah.
And I'd run to sort of the end of my road. If I wasn't going to do it for a job at that point, I'd just be repeating the same milestones. I remember I got offered a big gig for the third time running. The first time I did it, I was psyched because it was a big theatre and all of my heroes were on. Like Stuart Lee was playing, Richard Herring was playing. I was on the same bill as them in a theatre. And then I did it the second year, which was equally like, wow, this is great. This is still great. But by the third time, I declined because it was like, God. The dream's now just repeating. Nothing's changing now. I'm just covering the same ground. And as nice as it is, I'm giving up a lot of time traveling on trains and buses and walking and waiting in the dark and standing in a pub on my own, or, you know, eating at a funny hour. And yeah, after a while, it just runs down your enthusiasm. If I was going to do it for a job, I've kept plugging like you do, because you have to. But after a while, you're like, if I'm not going to do this, what am I doing? It's a very intrusive hobby.
Well, yeah, that does sound quite intrusive when you put it like that, and being a hobby. What do you think you need then if you're going to be like a professional stand-up, if you're going to do it? What do you need in order to be able to do that? Is it some kind of mental state of mind where you don't mind that repetition?
You need to be tenacious, you know, like, whereas me and a few people who I would bump into a lot would be willing the gig to be pulled. We'd be like, oh, please let something happen. Like sometimes if it was during the World Cup, there wouldn't be enough people to go ahead. And we'd be like, oh, please. And then five people would come in and you'd go, no. And whereas there were friends of ours who'd gone on to make it big time, like Lou Sanders, who would be desperate to perform, even if it was just a one person. And then they'd want to do five gigs a night, you know, and they really couldn't want it more. Yeah. Those are the people who are going to make it, because it's not repetition to them. It's absolute lifeblood. And it's what they're good at, and it's where they thrive. So, and it's funny, some of the people that it is what they're good at still don't, who don't want to do it. You know, like, poor, do you ever listen to Chatterbox?
I haven't, no.
Yeah, Joe Wilkinson and David Earl. Joe Wilkinson is torn, like me. I recognise a lot of what he said between wanting to kind of do this stuff. It taps into a part of you that you like accessing, but at the same time, finding it incredibly embarrassing. Like the implicit thing that I think I'm funny, and I think I'm funny enough to talk to you for money. And we would both cringe as we'd go on and go, oh, this is so embarrassing. And just couldn't square it, you know. But so he still continues in that world, albeit more as a writer, but you do see him on TV, obviously. Yeah. You know? But yeah, he's always, and him and David are always exploring that idea of not wanting to be that performer and that. I have struggled with that a lot as well. I struggled with the inferred arrogance of like, hi, listen to me. Listen to me talking. I'm so funny. I've decided that.
That's David Earl, isn't it? Is that the writer, David Earl?
Yeah, he's brilliant. And he really struggled with it. So, you know, he's like the biggest sort of critic of the whole performing thing. He always embarrasses Joe by saying, well, you can put on your invisible tap shoes. And Joe cringes. He knows where to get him, you know. He knows where that pain lives.
It's really interesting that, like, you have that self-awareness, or kind of, is that the right term?
It's almost too self-aware, isn't it? It's sort of out of body, whereas you should just be doing the thing. You're actually watching yourself doing the thing, thinking, what am I doing?
When you're at a pub or you're at a dinner party or whatever, like, and there's someone on the table, like, holding court, who thinks they're funny, how do you find that as an experience?
Excuse me.
You don't mind doing it not for money? You don't mind doing it?
Yeah, I think that almost I prefer unpaid. And that might be another reason I dropped out. The idea of taking money for turning up was cringe. But, you know, just knocking about, making people laugh on my own time, that's fine. But collecting money after is just crass.
You're good at this, but the thing is, I don't want to commit to it. This goes back, this is a commitment thing, right? It's too much. It's
non-committal to everything. That's what I discovered when I was thinking about the questions you sent me. My entire life is just avoiding things and dancing around them.
we've got the opening scene
Become a gangster.
You didn't become a gangster.
And we land me in the middle of my life, I think.
Yeah.
Like the middle of Goodfellas, middle of my life. So let's say I'm going to live to 73, 75. I don't know. What's the normal
your
age?
Film. It's your film.
75 is the average, isn't it? It's what they use on the NHS indicators.
Is it?
Yeah. They think it's an early death if it's under 75, I believe.
Right.
But if you're learning disabled, they put you at 65. Even though there's no particular reason why you should live less, but they've just downgraded you because you do tend to die younger because you're not able to express your medical needs, or maybe you're not being looked after. So they've just decided to write that in rather than deal with it. Yeah, I wrote a letter about that to the health department at one point, and they said they were going to look at it, but I think things have overtaken them since.
You mentioned Scorsese there. Is that like a, do you like Scorsese films? Do you like gangster films? If you want,
I like that one. I like Goodfellas. I'm not mad into gangster films, but he's obviously very good. So you should copy him because he obviously is doing well. So just look at who's doing well and copy them. That's what you should do.
No, you mentioned that, and I think we'll probably mention this later. You mentioned Peter Simon there on the Shopping Channel talking to himself and whatnot. You mentioned there, and I know you like particularly on your Twitter, you'll be watching it sometimes. You'll be like commentating on what's happening on the Shopping Channel. It's very funny. But I wonder, when you talk about gangster films and Scorsese, do you have any interest in those British gangster films, like the really kind of cheap ones that you see floating around sometimes? Do you ever
called like Mad Dog?
Yeah. Yeah.
$3.99 and the DVD rail.
Yeah, exactly.
Not particularly. If they're on, I'd curiously watch if someone had one on just to see what the fuss is about. My nan was one of those nans that knew the craze and said they were nice boys, kind of.
Oh, blimey.
Yeah, nice boys. Good to see mum.
You don't want to get the wrong side of your nan then.
No, I want to go that way. Actually, I said earlier, didn't I, that she was dead. She's not. Only one nan is dead. The other one is still alive, I believe.
Hang on a minute. Is that because she's in witness protection program? You've just given it away.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've just given her location away to the craze. She's in Elephant Castle.
Well, it's all changed around that way now. The shopping centre's gone and everything.
I know. That was absolute travesty. And what for? Probably more luxury apartments, I guess. We don't need it. We haven't got enough luxury apartments.
Christina, if there's one thing London hasn't got enough of, it's unoccupied flats people can't afford or people don't want to live in.
I really, really loved Elephant and Castle Shopping Centre. It was really odd. You know, it had those crazy little shops that one guy ran, you know, and were like a labour of love. And it always smelled, when you drove in a car, it always smelled of donuts from Tesco's. Yes, it always reminds me, the smell of donuts always takes me back to the Elephant Castle Shopping Centre.
The smell of donuts?
The smell of donuts could be another title for the film. The smell of donuts. I was going to say Wes Craven could make that film.
Wes Craven?
Yeah.
The horror. Craven.
He's dead, no, isn't the it? Other guy.
Or Wes Anderson.
You know that guy.
Wes Anderson's first attempt at a horror film in The Smell of Donuts.
Yeah. That's me, worried about people getting my name wrong. I mean, I'm very sorry. I'm a hypocrite. I admit it, at least.
Well, we've got the title and we've got the opening scene, but who's playing Christina Martin in Christina with an A? Who's the lead?
Well, this is good that I don't have to decide this because it's been decided for me. Because it's such an arrogant thing, isn't it, to decide who's going to play you. It's sort of effectively saying, oh yeah, this good-looking person can play me. So when I had one of my cases at work covered by The Untold, which is like a Radio 4 show, Grace Dent does the narration.
Yep.
And
yep.
She was describing me while I was walking along talking to the producer as determined and... this is great. This is down on record. She said, Christina's 38, which is no longer true, but at the time, correct time of going to press, Christina's 38, but she looks much younger. So I was sitting there listening to her going, yeah. And she said, if we were to make a movie version of The Untold, she'd be played by Anna Friel. And I thought, yeah, I could do that. I could go for that.
That's a really good shout.
Not overreaching too much, like as in I'm not going Angelina Jolie, please. She's a, you know, much better looking woman, but she's also accessible, down to earth, probably available. I reckon I could get her.
I mean, have you seen much of Anna Friel's work recently? She's done did ITV a couple of, she's a Marcella in ITV. And
I tend to just see the adverts for stuff like that. I know I'm aware of them through adverts when I'm waiting to watch something really bad, like Four in a Bed. Obviously that's not on ITV, but you know what I mean, that of that ilk. And then I see the adverts for the real telly that everyone else watches.
Yeah.
It's like dramas and shows and stuff, and I'm just like, no, let's get back to Four in a Bed.
So when you heard Grace Dent saying and if this was a movie version she'd be played by, what happened to your head as that sentence was being said out loud? Like, what was going on in your head?
What's she going to say?
Yeah.
What's she going to say? Oh, my God, please let it be complimentary. I mean, it sounded like she was building up to be complimentary, to be fair. I didn't have a shock in store because she was saying that I was, you know, gritty, steely, determined, you know. Yeah. So I thought, well, that's all good. That sounds like a bit like an ITV, like, detective, hard woman detective who solves crimes with her best mate. in a small town near Devon.
Yeah, yeah.
Steely Martin looking out for the locals, checking out what's been happening in the barns.
You know, if you just specialised in barn crimes,
yes. This barn seems to have been disturbed in the night. Some hay on the floor. Oh, it's just it was a cow. It's always a cow. It's always a cow.
Always a cow. Never an owl.
Yeah, no. Sometimes an owl. You know, if they get in. But if you secure your barn, that shouldn't happen. And if you're not securing your barn, I don't even come out for those, because if you haven't secured your barn, I don't consider it a crime. I consider it your fault. Have you secured your barn? No. Okay, then. Hanging up now.
Anna Friel is a really, really good choice.
Very reliable actor, very good at what she does. Everyone recognises her. So she's not like a big star that takes all the attention for who they are. Like, I go back again to Angelina Jolie. You watch a film with her in it and you think, that's Angelina Jolie. She's an actress who you think, you don't get subsumed by her. You know?
Yes. So yeah, you would prefer that your story be told through that conduit as opposed to that kind of people looking at that star.
Exactly. This is about Christina with an A.
So we've got the lead, Anna Friel. The opening scene is Christina with an A. But what genre would Christina with an A be as a film? And what sort of budget would you want to have? What are we looking at?
Well, let's think. Because life has many facets, doesn't it? Life isn't just drama. Life isn't just comedy.
Yes.
So I'm thinking I want action, horror, comedy, musical, and martial arts. With some foreign language section, because I do Japanese Wordle. So when I do Japanese Wordle in the film, we can have subtitles.
What?
For my guesses.
How do we work in Japanese Wordle into the film, and why Japanese Wordle?
Well, I do Wordle, like everyone, like the entire world do. Well, it's hard to say world when you're saying Wordle.
Wordle.
So I do Wordle, and then I do six-letter Wordle, and then I do Quirdle. It's a lot of admin. Oh, you're considering I don't like admin. I've created a real rod for my own back here. And then I do Japanese Wordle, which is you get 12 goes because there's so many characters, obviously, that you have to have more goes than your UK lot and your American lot.
Yeah.
Sometimes I use all of them, and I've guessed like two of the characters, but I'm still nowhere near because there's so many versions of words with those characters in that order. It's very tricky, but I do enjoy it.
So hang on.
I sound like a right pomps. Japanese Wordle.
How many characters is it kanji in is that how?
Oh, like there is a kanji one, but I wouldn't go near that because I've only managed to learn about 300 kanji, which sounds impressive, but when you consider there's about 2,000, I might as well know no kanji, because if you start reading and you hit one you don't know, that's it, the end. So I've learned the kana, because you've got hiragana, katagana, romaji, which is basically, if you see the word Tokyo in your mind's eye,
yeah,
you see T-O-K-Y-O, don't you?
Yeah.
So that's like English, the way they write their words in English letters.
Right.
Katakana is when you see really pointy Japanese words, like on the side of cereal or ice cream. That's boro words. So it would be aisukrimu, chokoreto, Super Mario. So right. Basically, they can say R. That's a big myth. Oh, L, I should say. R's and L's.
Yeah.
But they don't have the L in their sort of character list. They have A, Ka, Sa, Ta, Na, Ra. But they don't have la, so they just roll their R for L. Anyway, I'm getting bogged down. But what I mean by this is that they have to work with the sounds they've got. So in a katakana, you have to put those sounds together to make the nearest approximation, like computer. And sometimes it will come out funny because you don't have a neat ending for the sound.
Right.
So you just have to make one up. So that's why you get chocoreto or aisukrimu. So you don't just have cream. There's no m. That's katakana, really clumsily explained. But I'm playing hiragana. The kanji I don't even bother with. That's all the Chinese letters with two meanings each, which takes them up to about 4,000. I'm playing hiragana, which is the base Japanese symbols, which actually used to be the whole language. And then they brought in the Chinese stuff to make it too difficult for me to learn how to read. So
they purposely did that to you. That was basically
like, that to me.
Christina's getting too close.
Yeah. They really screwed me up there because I was getting somewhere. I'd done all the hiragana and katakana on my Nintendo DS. some game. And then suddenly there was all this Chinese stuff. And I was like, oh, well, thanks for that.
How long has this sort of interest in Japanese language and culture existed for you?
I first went to Japan in 2008. I obviously liked Japanese stuff before then, because I liked computer games as a kid. I was big into Nintendo from like the age of about 11, 12. So I always liked all the images that came out of the arcades, and all the game stuff influenced me. But when I finally went in 2008, yeah, I was just sold on it. So I've been about, I think, 3, maybe 4 times. I can't remember. What a terrible thing. Wow. I can't even remember. I think it's the last 2 years have meant I don't really know what's real anymore. Did I ever go to Japan?
No one does.
But yeah, when I went in 2008, I found it really hard to communicate with people with just my phrase book. It was worse than useless. I ended up going into a restaurant and managing to not order any food, even though I'd spoken to the waiter and pointed at a menu. Whatever I said with my stupid phrase book, you mispronounce one sound, that's it. So I'd managed, I sat there and I got no food, and people were just looking over at me and I was looking at them. Eventually I just left. But I don't know what I've done. But they weren't offended or anything. They weren't like not serving me because I'd said something like terrible in Japanese about their mum. They were just smiling at me like, that's fine, you sit there. You just have a table. So I realized I needed to learn to speak a little bit. So that's when I started doing lessons. And then I realized I enjoyed learning it because it's quite a fun language.
Is it? Is it fun? It sounds quite difficult, but is it? You obviously get a lot of fun from it.
Yeah. Like actually spoken, it's a lot easier than English, because whereas we have loads of little bit words like to and it and at, and they'll just say shashin or torimasu, which is just take photo. So when they sound choppy, when they talk to you in English and everyone makes fun of them going, take photo. Actually, that's all they're saying in their language. They're not wasting words. They're just saying take photo, eat food. You know, there's no flowery stuff all around it. Really clean and much easier to speak in. And also their language tells you a lot about them as well. So they're like, it's quite poetic. Like take photo means capture life.
It does not.
They use arimasu a lot, which means exists. So it always sounds really like philosophical whenever they say something, because they're going, does beer exist here? When they want to have a beer. Does beer exist here? I don't know. That's a big question, man. Does beer exist here?
So, oh, that's lovely.
I really like how beautiful it is when you translate it, how like cool it sounds and translate it literally.
That's so nice. And now you've been there, you've been to Japan, you've visited, and I think in Tokyo there's a giant Godzilla kind of poking up.
And a Gundam.
And a Gundam. So you say you want this to be action and horror and martial arts and musical. Does this mean that we're going to get some like...
Let's go to Japan.
Would you set it in Japan, or would you introduce during the film, would you have like Godzilla come in? Would you have... other big Japanese characters, Domukun or who?
Yeah, we can have a whole section. There's a robot that is in Aoyama in Tokyo, who 4 times a day puts on a show and dances, a humanoid robot. Yeah, called Asimo. He looks like a little spaceman. He's so humanoid. He's got fluid limbs and he can dance and he can bend. So he does these shows and shows you how he can dance. So that could be the musical section. I could do a dance number with Asimo, the humanoid robot. Free as well. They don't charge you. You just turn up at the Honda showroom in Aoyama, and he's there 4 times a day dancing around, and you just watch.
I would really love to see Asimo feature quite heavily in your biopic. Just kind of... moments just kind of dropping in for a little dance. Maybe it's transitions from one scene to the next.
Yeah, me and him, like buddy movie.
So this is a big budget film, I feel. Like obviously horror and action and musical and martial arts. By the way, brilliant. We've not had a martial arts sequence in one of these films yet. So I'm really pleased that you've popped in there. Any particular discipline that you want in there, or just kind of all of it, or anyone?
You know how there were always kids at school who did judo, really annoying kids at school who did judo?
Yeah.
Like that genre, just really bad, like level 1 judo. And they think they were hard. they were sort of on a par for me with the kids who always had like a flute with them or something. They're like, oh, you're a judo kid, you're a flute kid. again, I never had anything like that. I didn't have an accessory like that. I didn't commit to anything then either. I just hung around the playground. But yeah, level one judo kid martial arts, where they're just sort of kicking lightly.
and they can barely tie up their robes, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's it. Their mum had to tie their robe and they injure their toe if they kick their hard. That can be the scene in the, but I don't know where it fits, but we will find a way to put it in there, which, like, sure. If I have to write it in myself, I will find if I have to make up some stuff, I will.
I would love a mass brawl between child judo players. Just
really crap Karate Kid. Yes. Like Karate Kid on a budget sort of thing. Yeah. Like, they haven't really got it in them. Whereas Karate Kid has it in him and he has this innate ability. They're not getting it. They're never going to get it. They'll grow out of it. But when they're 13, they'll start feeling a bit self-conscious about it and won't want to do it. And their mum will be like, yeah, but you should keep it. No, I don't want to do it. I look stupid. Yeah, that whole thing.
I was also thinking along with that, you know how actors will put stuff on their resume or CV that they can't actually do? Like, I can absolutely fire a crossbow from horseback. Yeah, I can do that. And so if you just got loads of like child actors or youthful actors, you're like, oh yeah, I do judo all the time. Yeah, nothing but. And then you just, and it's just.
I know someone who's put, they can speak Afrikaans on their Star Now profile. No, they can't. I know they can't. I don't know why. And that's going to come out in the wash, isn't it?
You know, someone put they can speak Afrikaans on their.
Yeah. I don't know if it's a mistake that they put it there by mistake, but I know for a fact they can't. So I'd love to see them turn up for that job. You can lie your way through the door so much, can't you? But once you're through, really, come on. You know, it's gonna be exposed.
I just wonder as well, you mentioned about in Japanese language, sort of putting components of words together. Is Christina easy to say in Japanese?
This is another thing, right? You can kind of make certain words differently depending, like, because it's not a word in their language, you just use the sounds you've got available. I'd probably go ku, ri, su, pe, na. But a Japanese person might go differently on that, because there was a band I liked called Velt Punch.
What?
The words they make, the English words they make often don't make sense, you know, and vice versa, our tattoos of their language probably don't make sense now. And so I was looking for this band in Tower Records in Shibuya, you know, where that big crossing is.
Yep.
And the Japanese record shop guys couldn't find it because they weren't sure if it had been put under be or pe or all sorts of different permutations of the beginning of what, because they don't have ve. So they're like, well, it could be under, where would we have guessed to put it, you know, based on the fact we don't have BE in our language. So we were looking all over the shop, you know, until we could find it. So, yeah, basically you make it up as you go along. So some other Japanese person might decide it wouldn't be ku, no, it would be keru sutena.
How would you say Christina?
I'd probably go for ku, because you've got a, e, u, e, o is your base sounds. And then you take that to kaki kukeko sashi suseso tachi tuteto na ni nune no ma mi nune. So I'm going to go ku ri su te na. But I don't think that that's how a Japanese person would go with it, actually. I think they've got obviously much more dexterity with their language than I do.
But the thing is, Christina, when you say that, I immediately in my mind can see Christina with an A. And the Japanese film poster that it would have, because they often, you know, sometimes the lettering is very dynamic and dramatic. Yes. And they
with the katakana, proper katakana pointy letters that you get on Street Fighter. Yeah, like you get it on Street Fighter. Yeah, that kind of look, definitely for the, and you know the irony, right? They probably spell it Christine. And I wouldn't know, because it's hard to tell, you know, you're like, maybe that's right, I don't know. I don't have that name doesn't exist in your language. So
and so which parts of your life then are going to feature in Christina with an A, and which parts are going to, which what do they, what definitely has to be in there and why?
So much, isn't there? God. So where do I begin? I mean, I spent 6 years doing a daily spin and win competition on a biscuit website to win a gingerbread man.
Wait a minute. Six years on a what?
So there's a biscuit website. It's a really posh biscuit shop called Biscuiteers. You may have heard of it.
They've
They've got a Clapham outlet with nice little, you know, those lovely little furniture you get for the garden that's metal and twirly, that kind of, on the street outside. Proper overpriced gingerbreads. Like they'll make a gingerbread shape that, because it's an Easter bunny, they'll charge you a tenner. Right. Anyway, they have a website where there was a daily spin and win competition to win a gingerbread man. And when I got to about 2 years in, I thought, I can't stop now, because that's even worse than throwing away 2 years. So I kept going, and then 6 years in, I won a gingerbread man. So I could stop, I was released. I just feel like, as tedious as that is, it's almost a sort of Groundhog Day symbolic, sort of you could keep repeating the scene in an artistic way. Over and over, speeding up the, you know, the cuts as you get nearer to the 6 years. Then, yeah, biscuit. And then I get a biscuit and realise that wasn't worth it. And when I finally did win, I didn't really believe it, because I was so used to, I was almost thinking, it's just programmed to say you haven't won. I don't know what this is. But suddenly it went, you're a winner. And I just sat there. Am I? No, this is just my life now. I just come here every day, spin this thing three times and go away again until I die. And now I've won the biscuit. Nothing, no point in my life now. That's just gone now, that whole purpose.
Have you, I'm assuming you've deleted the website where you were going.
Yes, that's gone now. Actually, yeah. But I should admit, I'm doing similar with Dorset cereals now. They've got a daily spin and win that I'm getting involved with.
How many years are you into this?
Shame to say it, about four. This is becoming a bit of therapy. Don't really tell people these things usually. Why would you? It'd be weird.
I mean, I do like the fact that you say it has to be in there, like this gingerbread hell that every you just just doing that.
It's like a journey. It's like a personal journey, growth, and I suppose the realization that the things you wish for aren't necessarily worth the bother. What an inspirational message that would be to the audience. Don't bother. It's always going to disappoint you. Everything you dream of, everything you want. Nah. You'll get it and then you'll realise.
It's not what you thought it was. But the thing about there, you said about like kind of those years of taking part in that. Do you remember the TV show Psychoville?
Yes.
With Reese Shearsmith and Steve Pemberton. And there was a character in that played by Steve Pemberton who was looking for a particular Beanie Baby to complete his collection.
Yeah.
Do you remember that? And he got it and then he threw it in the sea at the end because it wasn't about getting it, it was about that journey of finding it. That was what was so exciting to him. What else would have to be in there if not obviously this gingerbread hell, as well as the gingerbread hell, sorry.
What else is there after that? Well, what do people want? I don't understand. I suppose if I have to actually do a biopic, I have to reference stuff I've done, don't I? Actual stuff.
It's up to you. It's your
film. I guess. It can't just be all the stuff I think is sarcastically funny. I guess you'd have to have some of my stand-up years there.
Yeah.
That's an interesting time.
What was it like being a stand-up? Was it what you expected?
Yeah, it was odd, actually, because I didn't know what to expect. I was watching one night at the Comedy Cafe. I think that's closed now, isn't it? But they had a middle section where you were just allowed to go up. I didn't realise you could just go up. Effectively, anyone can just go up. And you can then take that to the next step and just email a club and say, I'd like to go on. And that blew my mind. I always thought, like, you almost have to be interviewed, don't you? Like, you do job interviews, you have to be qualified. But actually, you could just turn up and do it. So it was always a bit odd to me. I always thought, you know, you burst on stage with a big light on you and you feel like you've arrived. But actually, it's you turn up and you walk on and you're you and you're still baffled. And you're talking and people laugh and you're like, okay, that's good, I suppose. You don't feel this, well, sometimes you get a bit of a buzz, but a lot of the time you just, the laughing sound is an indication that, okay, that worked. And then you walk off thinking, how did I get on there? That is odd. And the longer you go on, you're walking off past people who you regard as proper, whereas you're just an interloper. And you're walking off past, you know, Richard Herring and Stuart Lee and thinking, yeah, what? Why am I being let on here? I mean, great. And I go on and I do okay, but I still feel like, yeah, I'm going to go back to my job tomorrow. And that'll be my safe place. That's where I belong. So it's nice to have that night out where you actually get to join in.
Did you get scared? Was it? I mean, I know obviously people talk a lot about imposter syndrome these days.
Oh, yeah.
But did you, like you say about walking past these people and going, oh, I'm going to get back to work tomorrow and that's my safe place. What, did you get a little bit frightened or nervous or what was?
Yeah, I mean, you naturally have the stomach reaction. So your physical self might, in your head, in your brain, might feel calm. But obviously your tummy tells you the truth about how you're feeling. So I'd always, and a lot of people say this, a lot of times before the gig, you'd be going to the toilet a lot. So you'd know physically you weren't comfortable, even if you were feeling like you've done this before. And then some gigs would be nerve-wracking because you knew they were going to go horribly. So you'd seen everyone before you die horribly. And it was like going up to an execution block yourself. It's my turn to be hanged by the neck kind of thing, you know? I mean, there was one we did where one of the acts actually went home. They just said, I'm not doing it. And I couldn't do that. I was the compere. I was the person who had to keep going out for this horrible crowd. And then I didn't even have 10 minutes where I could go off because this person had ditched. So naturally, you're afraid for yourself at those points because it's just horrible. It's not nice when people are like shouting at you and generally impossible to corral. I mean, I'm one of those people who tries not to say, oh, it was it was a big room. It was not right for comedy. Oh yeah, the ceiling was a bit high. Cause you'd hear that a lot after a lot of gigs. The tables were set up so they were sideways faces. So that meant I couldn't ever do a good gig in that environment. It's like, yeah, right. But this really was just like, not manageable. No one was going to stop talking, shouting. Yeah, it almost felt like we all should have just gone home, to be honest. And Boris Johnson was there.
What?
It was a fashion week thing. I don't know what he was doing there. Had no place in fashion. And it was a load of students, so they weren't really interested in the stand-up element. They were there for the fashion shows that were randomly going on between gig. And he was there because he was mayor of London. I'm just so sorry I didn't abuse him from up on the stage as I should have done. I was just didn't realize how, I knew he wasn't a great guy, but I didn't realize how terrible he would end up, or damaging he would end up being.
Yeah, it's hard to foresee that kind of extent.
Yeah.
Was he joining in with the barracking, or was he just
it sitting? Was so hard to tell, you know, because it was so crowded. There were like 500 people there. And I just knew he was there because I'd seen him come in back. But I assume, knowing his character, that he would have been joining in. Probably starting it, probably leading the charge. Like, yes, heckle the woman. Tell her she's shit. Yeah, gigs like that, almost. After the first sort of bit of it going wrong, you sort of almost relax into it because nothing's changing.
It's interesting you mentioned that, because often in films or TV, there are sequences where at comedy clubs or gigs where the crowd's turning, and then someone comes on and then like somehow wins them back and turns it all around and it all sorts. Is that a complete lie? Is that, if you never experienced that? And that doesn't sound like that was ever going to happen there.
I think if there's a manageable crowd, like crowds can get leery. But if they're a comedy crowd, you can have that. So if you're up the creek, something like Up the Creek, you will have times when someone completely loses the room and everything goes really wrong and people are throwing stuff or shouting. And,
oh my God.
And then you can have someone who comes out, because they're a comedy crowd, however out of control and leery, they actually appreciate it and are suddenly on side. And you can see that that roller coaster on some nights, if it's a comedy night. That one was a fashion show, so it was never going to be a comedy night, and they were never going to listen to anyone who came out. But yeah, you can have those moments, those bits. And sometimes if it's you who's doing it as well, that's a great feeling. If you're the person who comes on and saves the gig at a set, it's a nice feeling. You get to feel that kind of held aloft football player by cheerleaders kind of feeling once in your life.
Have you had that?
I have actually, yeah. I had a gig when no one was doing well. And I went on and I did amazing. I hate recounting things like that, but it just sounds like, which was nice. But it does happen. It's happened to us all. And I'll also, for balance, be the person who goes on and kill, you know, absolutely bombs, and someone else takes that.
Well, you deliberately do that after you do really well. You deliberately got to do it all for the karmic balance.
You've got to ground yourself. But yeah, the gigs will do it for you because you get booked at all sorts of different random things. And but sometimes they're completely wrong and you don't know why you've been booked. I got booked at a golf club in the middle of the Sussex countryside. And it was just loads and loads and loads of old guys who all wanted Jimmy Tarbuck. So I don't know what their entertainment person was thinking. And all to a person hated me. And I actually remember being quite angry at that gig because I was on my own. I was the only act because it was a Christmas thing. I was just the act. That was it.
Oh man.
While they had their dinner. And I knew before I went up that they were not happy. They were all looking at me and whispering. Everything I said got nothing. And old men heckling you in tuxedos is so weird. I did say at one point, I mean, you're not very nice, are you, you lot? Not very nice. I'm the only person, I'm on my own here. You all know each other. But yeah, I got nothing because they just were determined to hate me. But I did get paid handsomely because those kind of gigs, anyone will tell you, a corporate or a Christmas or something like that pays good money. It's horrible. That's why it pays good money, because it's an endurance challenge. No one wants you there. Everyone's treats you like a jester who they can shout things at.
That feels like another compelling reason not to continue in that career or to make it into a career.
Well, yeah, it's how much that can you take? I mean, once you get to a nice level, like I was talking to Stuart Lee on Sunday about, because he's on tour, and once you get to the level where people are coming for you, that reduces down a lot, you know, because why would people pay 30 quid, 40 quid to see you and then ruin their night? I mean, it still happens, don't get me wrong. I once saw David Cross in a place in London, in a jazz club in London. And it was a one night only thing, and it was queuing down the road to get in, and there's still hecklers. And you just think,
wow,
dang, you know, we've got David Cross here for one night.
Yeah.
Why are you ruining it? And they weren't friendly hecklers. They weren't trying to help. They were really disrupting everything. So it's a strange one. But, you know, yeah, if you can get to the point where people are paying just to see you, you probably don't have that quite as much.
So which then are the moments you wouldn't have? Which moments would you want on the cutting room floor?
The year I spent working on a dummy reception desk, probably.
Huh?
This reception desk, right? It was just purely like for display purposes.
What?
There was this building at the end of Liverpool Street, very end, like where it finishes and becomes Aldgate. And you can see where British Land, looking after the pavement, stops, because they have guys that go along the pavement, like polishing it with toothbrushes. And then you suddenly get the pavement that we all have, the normal pavement. And so I was sitting on the corner of Aldgate and Liverpool Street and this big glass building, which was for a series of different companies. And they didn't really need a reception, like no one ever visited, but they had it. They had this little round desk with a phone and nothing else.
What?
And they needed someone to just sit there. So I was working at the time for a company. They provided executive receptionists to anyone who wanted them. So you were like a uniformed air hostess scarf, little black suit, high heels, you had to wear lipstick, and you had to have your hair in a ponytail, and they would come and inspect you.
What?
To make sure your hair was just right and your lipstick was applied. If you didn't, because I went to one reception desk once when I was covering someone who was just going home sick, and she hadn't put her hair right, and the woman who had come in and seen it, and she started dragging her head back by doing a ponytail, like when your mum, when you were a kid, would be pulling your hair and you'd be going, ah, you know, stay still. And she did a ponytail of this woman's hair with a horrible rubber band from the post, which was pulling her hair out. And just, wow, this is horrific. For the sake of having a woman sitting, looking at nothing all day, just staring to the middle distance in an air hostess scarf, this is inhumane. So it was my job to just sit there and display. And the people, right? There was a woman who worked there who was like in the finance, like it was a big finance company in the city. They spotted me sipping some water. You weren't allowed food or drink at the reception desk, even though you sat there from 8 till 6 with only half an hour break. You weren't allowed food or drink at your desk. I had a cold and I needed water. So I had a little bottle of water under the desk. And she saw me swigging and she reported me to my guardian, who checked my hair and makeup. And she came in and said, I heard you've been drinking water. And it's like, prisoners of war get it easier than this. And they're allowed food.
I've heard you've been drinking water.
What do you say to that?
I mean, so they would check, hang on a minute. They would check your lipstick was applied in a certain way.
They check you had it on and then they, you know, make sure it was nicely done, you know.
Was there a colour? Was there like a uniform colour you had to have?
Yeah, kind of ready. This is like an escort agency for people who just wanted someone to sit on a chair for them.
It sounds a little bit window dressing.
It was the most regressive thing ever. But I just needed a job at the time, so it's all right, I'll sit in a chair for you. But even after a while, sitting in a chair, which wasn't a good enough deal for me, I was like, no, there's too many bad things here. But
that's wild.
But that would, I don't know if that should be on the cutting room floor, actually. It's quite formative.
I mean,
should anything be on the cutting room floor, really?
Well, let's not have anything. I mean, you've got your gingerbread hell and you've got your lipstick hell, so we've got got all these different hells going on.
I think it's important people know how much I've been through.
So what would you say, apart from these various hells that you've been through, what are the influences on Christina with an A from film or TV or literature or theatre or comics? Are there particular influences? I know we started off with Scorsese and Goodfellas, but is there anything else that you would...
I think for the silly bits, Viz is a good influence.
Yep.
You know, you'd have to have that because I've written for them and that's my kind of humour. That would be a big influence. A Fist of Fun, actually, for my sarcasm and delivery. I think the way I speak, a lot of it is down to Rich and Stu, the intonation, because I just sat and watched that on video over and over.
Yeah.
I can't help it. When I first got reviewed, I ran home to read this review because I just placed in this comp and the reviews were going to be out that night. So I knew I had a review at last. And I was happy but disappointed when the reviewer said she's obviously heavily influenced by Stuart Lee and the debt is so heavy that you can't help but just hear everything she says in his voice. And I thought, isn't that, that's bad, isn't it? That's not what you want. I don't want to be a karaoke stand-up. But it's so impossible to get away from because I grew up on that. They're almost like my comedy parents. So my delivery and the way I speak has to come from Fist of Fun. My silliness has to come from Viz. And lack of respect for anything.
It's really interesting because you were the first female writer on Viz. Is that right?
Yeah.
So how did you first find Viz? Like, how did you find Viz?
Oh, yeah. Well, I started writing letters because, again, like with stand-up, I didn't know you had permission to do anything outside of what you do. So I just used to read stuff and think, well, people do that. I don't do that. That's not what I do. I imbibe this. I read it. But so I just thought, oh, well, I've got an idea for a joke. And I wrote a letter and it got in. And that sort of magical thing of, oh, all right, you can just get stuff in then.
Yeah.
So and I was doing stand-up at the same time. So it was this sudden thing of, oh, I'm allowed to, oh, wow, okay. And then I had like 1 month where I sent in like, I think it was about 15 letters and they all got in. And the different names, like they changed the names.
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, I like those themed letters pages, you know, where it's like about pears or something or bread. So I wrote one about ghosts and I wrote one about pears and that got in. And then articles, I sent them articles and they were like, yeah, that's going in. I was a bit spoiled actually because Viz basically their only rule is if it makes them laugh, it goes in. Whereas right. when you work on places like BBC Writers Room, where the life gets sucked out of an idea slowly over 5 days. Sorry, but it's true. Some of the most boring, depressing places I've been in writers' rooms. With Viz, you have a funny idea, you write it down and they print it. I might change it a little bit for their own purposes, but ultimately there's none of that long, tedious, oh, well, let's just change the entire joke, you know?
Right.
And so, yeah, I just kept sending and they just kept printing. And yeah, that's been the same way it was with stand-up. It's like, I'll have a go at that. Oh, okay then. And then I just carried on until I didn't.
Yeah. I mean, and with because Viz and Lee and Herring, was there kind of a, what was the gateway to both of those things? Was it just the fact you turned it on one night, or you like TV, yeah. or like with Viz, you just saw lucky. The news agent or something?
I was lucky to be like a zennial, like that micro gen where I was just hitting the right age to have really good telly in like 1995, six. Actually, this is when we were on the radio before that. I remember hearing a bit of them on the radio. I was just at that right time where I was. Well, I wasn't going out on Friday nights and Saturday nights like a lot of people in my town. Like, I went to an all-girls school and all the girls were going out and getting drunk at the bus stop or getting pregnant. And I didn't fit anywhere. I didn't have best friends. I didn't have friends groups. So I just like stayed in and played Nintendo and watched telly and things like Kids in the Hall, Fist of Fun, felt like my friends group.
Right.
And so that's why it's really weird being friends with people like that now. It's like I've manifested my friends.
Do you ever take them down to a bus stop and get drunk with them just to try and kind of fit in the catch up?
Yeah, try and get them pregnant. So yeah, it's really strange how it's worked out, because I always used to sit in front of the TV thinking, these are my people. I reckon I'd be friends with them. And I really feel that. I just now need to find out if I could be friends with Bruce McCullough. He was my favourite Kids in the Hall, and I always used to think, oh yeah, I'd get on with him. But obviously he's in Canada, so I can't necessarily find out the way I did with Richard Stewart. I'm sure we would.
Undoubtedly. I'm sure when this goes out, it will make its way to him, and before you know it.
Hi, Bruce.
What about the critics, Christina? Christina with an A. What about the critics? If they love it or hate it, how would that affect you and your next project?
I don't know. Nothing good is appreciated in its own lifetime, is it?
So that's deep.
So that's a really good way, if you get a bad review, to just go, ah, but I don't want you to like it, because that would invalidate the art.
Van Gogh never sold any paintings when he was alive. I think you'll find.
Thank you very much. And so maybe a bit of posthumous appreciation, but a legend status, documentaries about how I was ahead of my time. And you're all sorry that you didn't realise at the time, and you would apologise to me if you could. You know, I think that's stronger than being appreciated at the moment, because everyone's regret would overcome them and I'd become like Elvis.
Does that annoy you when people aren't appreciated enough? And then, you know, they pass and then everyone's like, oh my God, they were so amazing. And you just think, well, I like them all.
Yeah.
Why did no one just say they were really good? Why does everyone have to just hold it in?
Yeah, say it at the time. Because I said this a few times on Twitter when I'm being very rarely sincere. Because I go to a fair amount of funerals and I will always come back and say, you know, just say it, please. Because I hear a lot of praise for people after they're gone. Someone sent me a message just this morning about how they'd spoken to a friend of their a person who's died that they know, who was gushing about them, and they'd never heard any of this stuff about them before, any of the stuff they were saying they'd done, you know, even. And I've been to enough funerals where you even are finding out the stuff they've been up to after they're dead, much less praising them for it. And it's just like, we go around keeping it all under wraps, and then we talk to a box at the end of it. It's such a strange species we are.
Because you work in, just to clarify, you arrange funerals. Your day job is you arrange funerals for people who have no next of kin or have died alone.
Yeah, no next of kin or no means. So I see a lot of posthumous appreciation, and it's great you know, but you're not here to hear it.
Do you, and do you, does that, has that made you then tell people more often since you started doing this job and have seen these events? Do you tell people more regularly how much you appreciate them? And
yeah, I think I'm a bit more loose now, you know, like I've always been very standoffish, very sarcastic, very uptight. My upbringing was very much like that. So I hide behind a big wall of sarcasm and jokes. I mean, the reason I got into comedy is it's my language. I can't be serious. I find it really hard to be serious. But it's actually made it so that I can be sincere without thinking, oh my God, I want to make myself throw up with this sincerity. You know, I can actually do it now without feeling too compromised, too cheesy, you know, because you have to have some sincerity. You can't just be this sarcasm bot. You can't just be Chandler Bing your whole life. You know, it's just not good enough.
Yeah. I've always found him to be an immensely annoying character. I thought, you know, he would.
Yeah, it's like a rhythm of speaking where you know the only thing that's going to come out next is another punchline. And I know he's a written character, to be fair to him, as a script, but you know, I was kind of like that. That was all I would do, was call and response. And it's like, where's the human under there?
Yeah.
Well, the jokes, you know, sort of time and place for occasionally just saying something nice to someone. Because, you know, it is so incredible when you do hear it. Because sometimes, again, I cringe myself here. Sometimes I get messages on Twitter from people, direct messages, saying, you've made my day today, or something, like with something silly I've done, like a joke or something I've said. And you do get this massive, like, oh, that's amazing. And just from one thing, just a small thing, small compliment. So if people did that more, I think we'd all be a lot happier and a lot less paranoid about what people think about us. Because if you're trying to decipher it all the time, it's quite a, you know, you can spend time thinking even your friends don't like you, don't you? If they've been quiet and stuff, you can suddenly convince yourself that nobody likes me, or friends don't like me. Actually, people are off thinking nice things about you all the time, but they're bathing their kids, so they don't have their phone in their hand to tell you. So, you know, they think the thought and it's gone, and you're thinking, oh, I haven't spoken to them in 2 weeks, so they hate me. If we could just all assure each other of what we think, you could all just relax.
If we, well, you're not saying hashtag be kind, I'm assuming. You're just
no. That vapid stuff means nothing. I mean, what do you mean? It's usually wielded by people not very kind either, is it? Be kind to me or I will attack you. Be kind about Captain Tom or I will attack you. They're always primed and ready for a fight, the be kind people. be reasonable.
That's the new social media movement which will start after this. Yes. and so I like the fact that critics won't affect you, and actually, yeah, okay, be nice, you know, tell people how much you appreciate them, but at the same time, posthumous praise and make everyone feel terrible for not being nicer to you while you were still here.
Yes, I think that captures the complexity and hypocrisy of my character.
Now, where's the premiere of Christina with an A going to take place? Where's the premiere and who's invited?
So I think the Prince Charles Cinema, because it's a really alternative place, isn't it? Where you can have like fun. You don't have to just sit still and not say anything, because they did like sing-alonger, you know, musicals and shout along to the room.
Yeah.
So people could shout to my film. They could sing to the musical bits. They could dance to the Asamo bits. They could do martial arts to the martial arts bits and judo. And throw stuff at the screen like they do at the room. You know, I don't know what they throw. For the room, you throw spoons, don't you? You take plastic spoons and you throw them. So throw something at me, whatever you want. And
Wordle scores?
Yeah, do Wordle and then post all your scores at the same time. Shout out your scores. Just make it a real interactive feast.
That's nice. That's nice. And who's invited? Who's invited to the premiere?
Well, I'd have to invite my mate because he had a premiere there. And he invited me, so I'd have to invite my mate Barry, because they did, you know, that podcast, The Parapod. It's about ghosts. They had a film. They made a film of their podcast.
Oh.
And the premiere was in January 2020, just before the world ended.
Eek.
At the Prince Charles Cinema. So that was one of the last big socials I had before everything went a bit.
Yeah. Whoop.
And so I'd had to invite him because he's literally invited me to a premiere there before. I think I'd invite Tommy Wiseau.
Oh, wow.
Because, you know, for once, it wouldn't be his film getting shouted at. He could watch someone else get viciously mocked and just feel like a little better that night about himself. I'd probably invite the woman who monitored my hair at the reception job, just so I've moved on. I've overcome.
Well, because I'd love the sequence where she sees Anna Friel sitting behind a desk and the hair and the lipstick isn't quite right and she can just sit there stewing.
She can think about that. If you see it sort of represented artistically, it might reframe it in your mind and make you realise everything you did, you know, ooh, yeah, it was dodgy when I grabbed that woman's head.
I reckon and then, Anna Friel would fight back pretty... I can't see Anna Friel standing for that.
That's the judo scene, that one.
And now I wonder who isn't invited and why? And why aren't they invited?
Who's absolutely not invited? The cereal company with the who aren't letting me win the cereal and releasing me.
Dorset cereals.
Or maybe I should invite them and maybe that might, you know, precipitate me finally winning. You know?
Yeah.
If they meet me, they might go, oh, go on. Just let her win. I don't want to exclude anyone. Putin, obviously, after what he's been up to, but I don't think he'd come anyway. I think it wouldn't be for him. anyone who won four in a bed by underpaying, those are the main people I would exclude. If you spent a week underpaying just so your B&B could win in the most minor way possible, you cannot come to my premiere.
Well, Christina Martin, there we have it. Christina with an A, featuring The Bus to Hungrytown, Bernard Cribbin's Travelator Technique, Name Auto Correction, Starting in the Middle, Giving Up Your Dreams, The Smell of Donuts, Anna Friel, Securing Your Barn, Japanese Wordle, Asimo the Dancing Robot, Hairstyle Judo, A Dummy Reception Desk, and Gingerbread Hell. Christina Martin, congratulations on being greenlit.
Thank you. Oh my God, it sounds so good. I can't wait to see this.